Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. On Disrespect for You this week, we hope to have two shows. This is an all-news show. Friday morning, we're going to collect the stats from the voting and tell you what it means to you. We hope to post that show on the web in advance of our regular Thursday broadcast at radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find it under the show's name, Disrespect. Now, at Disrespect, I don't usually regard my own experiences as entertainment for my listeners, but it's election day, and today I visited the Superior Court Motions Counter, the Director of Court Operations, the Justice of the Peace Intake, Service Ontario. I was on phone queues at Ontario Human Rights Legal Advice without an answer. Finally, I left a message with the Lieutenant Governor of Ontario. The question? Who can tell me how to lay a claim through the courts under the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act? Yes, I know you can lay a claim with the Ontario Human Rights Commission, and I know people scoff at their penalties, but nobody who was available to speak to today had even seen or heard of the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. If you haven't voted, do us all a favor and consider this. For now, first story today. Deaf rebels take up arms again against Gaddafi. Soldiers equipped with enhanced senses gaining respect on the front lines. Khalid Mustafa Sati fights in silence. Sati can see the smoke and flames from his gun as he fires at Muammar Gaddafi's soldiers, but he cannot hear the bullets, nor does he have a voice to speak of the death and violence he has witnessed during this uprising. Sati's one of Misurata's many heroes, praised for his courage and quick thinking on the battlefield. He now heads a unit of 86 men. What sets them apart is that they are deaf. Of the 86 members of the Deaf and Mute Brigade, only 7 can hear, and they are fluent in Libyan Sign Language and act as interpreters for the other. Without the ability to hear, other senses often become more acute. Sati recounted one occasion when they entered the basement of a shop and his sharp vision spotted a tiny movement through a corner window. Motioning the others back, he took aim with his AK-47 rifle, killing a Gaddafi soldier seconds before he released a grenade into the room, saving all those with him. When operating heavy weapons, these soldiers have no problems with the noise. This week, several members were chosen to form the security team for the visiting leader of the National Transitional Council, Mustafa Abdel Jibril, who praised them for their courage and impressive work for the revolution in an emotional meeting with members of the group. The newfound acceptance and support has given the men, who were often discriminated against and even feared under the Gaddafi regime, confidence and fulfillment, said Mohammed Hussein Gabag, the brigade's spokesman and main translator. Now, when people meet us at checkpoints, we get a great reaction because they see the efforts we have made to help the city. Several deaf members have been injured in the fighting, including Sati, who was struck by shrapnel twice and hit in the torso by a 23-millimeter bullet. Despite that injury, he returned to the front line 3 days later. Said Sati, "I saw them heading out to battle. Some returned, some didn't. Others came back injured. They clearly needed more men. That story by Tracy Shelton from the Global Post. Global Revolt of the Have-Nots. The Arab Spring that turned into a bloody summer. Protests in Europe culminating in riots in London and elsewhere in Britain. Demonstrations across Israel. Unrest even in faraway Chile and India. Though it's possible to point to causes unique to each country, they all seem to have in common a revolt against the ever-growing gap between the haves and the have-nots. As Thomas Friedman put it in a recent New York Times column, anger is being globalized. Don Peck, a features editor of The Atlantic, has adapted his new book into an article in the journal's September issue, in which he cites some alarming statistics. All the action at the American economy was at the top. The richest 1% of households earned as much each year as the bottom 60% put together. They possessed as much wealth as the bottom 90%. And with each passing year, a greater share of the nation's treasure was flowing through their hands and into their pockets. Merlin Emanuel, a black British social activist, has another take. We call them criminals, and they look at the bankers. We call them violent murderers, and they look at the police. We say they're void of morals and integrity, they look at the politicians. His references are, of course, to the money managers who've misappropriated billions entrusted to them, yet only occasionally end up in jail, to instances of police brutality, and to the British MPs who cheated on their expenses. As blacks are often among the angriest, also in Britain, Emmanuel writes, is it black people who outsource your jobs to foreign territories and then open up borders to immigrants who will compromise your right to earn a decent living by working for peanuts? Mercifully, Canada has so far been spared much of the unrest that has bedeviled other countries. But we're by no means immune to their problems. The gap between rich and poor is not diminishing here, and the continuous onslaught by all levels of government on the funding of welfare agencies is bound to punish those most in need. Prudence, humility, and social responsibility, not smugness, are called for. As we think of our own vulnerability manifest in the unrest in Toronto a year ago and in Vancouver last June. That story by Dow Marmer, Rabbi Emeritus at Toronto's Holy Blossom Temple in the Toronto Star. Rich versus poor gap exploding. Canada's becoming a nation of haves and have-nots as the gap between rich and poor is increasing at the fourth fastest pace out of 17 countries, according to a Conference Board of Canada report. Since the mid-1990s, the income gap here has been widening faster than that of the United States, currently the country with the biggest disparity between rich and poor, the report said. High inequality both raises a moral question about fairness and can contribute to social tensions, said Ann Golden, president and chief executive of the conference board. In Canada, the gap between the rich and poor has widened over two decades, especially compared to our peer countries. Most of that wealth is tied up in homes, with property accounting for over half of the gain, StatsCan said. And again, that credited to the QMI agency with no byline. In the free newspaper, 24 hours. Spend smarter to cut poverty. The National Council of Welfare cites Toronto program as a successful initiative. Women Moving Forward helps single moms on welfare get education, employment. It would have taken $12.6 billion to give the 3.5 million Canadians living in poverty enough income to rise above the poverty line in 2007. And yet Canadians spent at least double that amount treating the consequences of poverty that year, says the National Council of Welfare. Instead of focusing on short-term spending that simply enables people to survive, or be a little less disadvantaged, Canada should be investing in long-term plans to permanently lift people out of poverty and prevent others from falling into its grip, says the report. It recommends a Canada-wide strategy to solve the problem. Sustained investment, a consistent and coordinated approach based on fairness and reasonable reward for work effort, and a forum to share and learn from success. Quote, we're hoping Canadians will talk to their politicians and say, Let's shift our thinking to an investment-based approach. Let's save dollars. Let's make sure everyone is better off, unquote, said Council Chair John Rook. That from the Torstar News Service in the free paper The Metro News. Poor back of line for housing. Policy of giving priority to abused families means those living in poverty wait longer. A new report shows that the chronological system used to place families in homes is failing the poor. Families living in poverty are being bumped down on the first-come, first-served municipal list by families escaping domestic abuse, who leapfrog to the front of the line because of a provincial policy that gives them priority. According to a new study, 70% of applicants give up when they can't find housing within 4 years and drop off the list. The study by a task force of social housing advocate groups and municipalities shows that annually fewer than half of the subsidized units in the GTA go to the low-income residents. Their names will languish on wait lists for a minimum of 5 years before getting a unit, on average. Battered families, who represent only 4% of social housing applicants, are getting 43% of the units, most of them within 6 months. That by the Torstar News Service, again in the free Metro News. Lack of care traps elderly in hospital, report says. Health deteriorates as Ontario seniors wait for home care services. Ontario has the dubious distinction of having the worst hospital bottlenecks of any province, says a much-anticipated report prepared for the government. More than 4,500 senior citizens are stuck in hospital beds, even though they are in need of alternate levels of care, such as intensive home care, said Dr. David Walker, former Dean of Health Sciences at Queen's University and the report's lead author. The findings echo a STAR investigation last winter. The report was turned in on June 30th, but was quietly posted on the Health Ministry's website 2 months later, on the eve of the current election. Opposition critics accused the government of hiding its findings. And that by Teresa Boyle, health reporter in the Toronto Star. Healthcare workers take it to the streets. Healthcare workers from across the province descended on Queen's Park September 13th with a loud message for provincial parties. Nurses, patient groups, seniors groups, and other healthcare workers demanded commitments from party leaders in support of healthcare staff, stopping hospital bed closures, and keeping healthcare public. Said Natalie Mayra, director of the Ontario Health Coalition, they are looking for politicians to solve overcrowding in large municipal hospitals and the waiting list to get into nursing homes, among other issues. Ontario has now the fewest hospital beds per person of virtually all industrialized countries, and services like physiotherapy are being cut all across the province. We have some serious access to care issues in Ontario that need to be addressed, she said. We need the provincial parties to answer to these questions. That by Rosalind Solomon in the free newspaper 24 Hours. And perhaps our longest edited clip of this segment of the show, because it offers a lot of detail, modest new thinking on health. If health means shorter wait for surgeries, more nursing homes, more MRI machines, and more pharmaceuticals, all three provincial parties pledged to increase medical spending should ease voters' fears. If health means having enough to eat, a decent place to live, safe drinking water, an income that allows wholesome choices, a non-toxic environment, and the opportunity to be a productive member of society, medical spending is the wrong yardstick. Ontario does a relatively good job of patching people up after they get sick. It does a relatively poor job of keeping people, especially disadvantaged people, out of hospitals and long-term care institutions. It's no coincidence that the highest morbidity rates in the province are among the working poor, social assistance recipients, people with disabilities and mental disorders, and members of First Nations. And it's long been clear that conventional medicine delivered in doctors' offices, hospitals, and operating rooms doesn't have an answer to this problem. What isn't changing much, although there are promising signs, is the way health dollars are spent. What is barely changing at all is the reluctance of Ontario's politicians to address the factors that condemn 412,000 children in this province, half of them in Toronto, to unhealthy choices, preventable diseases, and foreshortened lives. None of the political parties are proposing to raise welfare rates. $592 per month for an individual, $1,014 per month for a single mother raising a child. They've all said no to a nutrition supplement, $100 a month, proposed by public health officials, led by Dr. David McKeown, Toronto's Medical Officer of Health. One party, the NDP, supports a provincial housing benefit, $100 a month for Ontarians who spend more than half of their income on rent. Only the New Democrats would raise Ontario's minimum wage to $11 from $10.25. The Conservatives are pledging to increase investments in home care and ensure that mental health doesn't get lost in the system. Liberals are proposing to help seniors retrofit their homes with ramps, walk-in shower stalls, and mechanical lifts, a $1,500 tax credit. Revive doctors' house calls. Offer family caregivers up to 8 weeks of paid leave if they can get Ottawa to cover the cost. And set a goal of reducing childhood obesity by 20% within 5 years. The New Democrats are promising to invest $1 million in home care, open 50 new community health care clinics, help seniors stay in their homes by hiring housekeepers to help them with laundry, meal preparation, and cleaning, and make phys ed mandatory in high school. None of these proposals is bold. No party proposes a major reallocation of health care funds. No leader is offering to tackle Ontario's health inequities. But it's a start. A modest, politically painless start. That by Carol Gore in the Toronto Star. Take a break with me with Steve Strongman. Appropriately on Election Day, lie to you.
I'm thinking of her all of the time.
was a joker who loved swimming and go-karting, driving with his dad, and making silly jokes with his younger stepsisters. And while he used a walker at school more as protection from the jostling of his fellow students, he proudly walked outside on his own, his young shoulders pressed back so that he could maintain his fragile balance and not fall. Mitchell Wilson's father is a big man, tough and strong, with a smile that comes easily, until he begins relating what happened that morning, just over 2 weeks ago, when he went into his son's bedroom to wake him up for his first day of grade six. His tormented 11-year-old child, who'd been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, had tied a plastic bag around his head, weary of the bullying and terrified of the young mugger he was supposed to face in court next week. Quote, if he had been treated with respect, if he had been treated with some empathy, some sympathy, as Dad says, he'd probably still be here, unquote. It was during one of Mitchell's beloved walks last fall that everything changed. He'd borrowed his dad's iPhone so he could listen to music and used it to call home and check about dinner time. In the nearby schoolyard, a young punk spied the cell phone. The 12-year-old jumped the disabled boy, slamming Mitchell's mouth so hard into the pavement that he broke his teeth. The young offender was arrested the next day, charged with assault and robbery in order to stay 500 meters away from his victim, an order he breached at least twice. Mitchell was never the same after the mugging. He lost the spark in his eye, his father explains. He realized how weak he really was and how he was unable to defend himself. The thief's friends began bullying Mitchell at school and following him home, demanding to know why he was taking their pal to court. Mitchell stopped sleeping and began suffering anxiety attacks. He told his family he'd rather kill himself than go back to school where he was being bullied. The young offender goes to court next week, but Mitchell's family has been warned the charges will likely be dropped since the boy is no longer here to identify him. They still want to deliver their victim impact statements just the same to try and tell this young criminal what he set in motion in the slim hope that he will think before preying again on the vulnerable. Wilson said, I'm hoping my emotions would affect him. I want him to get it. I want him to truly get it and not blow it off. But I'm not sure if he's capable of having those feelings, Wilson said fiercely. That story by Michelle Mandel of the QMI Agency in the free paper, The 24 Hours. Disabled, strip-searched, and humiliated. Parkdale man, 35, accuses Toronto police of racial profiling. We can handle this one of two ways, Constable Paul Mohit allegedly told Vaughn Nemhard as he sat handcuffed in the back of a police cruiser on Queen Street last February. We let you go now and you forget this ever happened, or we charge you with assaulting a police officer. Nemhard thought of what his father had told him the last time he was stopped and questioned by police. Make them put everything on the record. Take me to jail, he said. Mohit's partner, Constable Lucas Alexandrowicz, shook his head. Nemhard, a 35-year-old Rogers customer service agent, is accusing Toronto police of racial profiling and discrimination after he was arrested in February for assaulting a police officer, a charge that was later dropped. Nemhard believes he was targeted by police, slapped with a bogus charge, and arbitrarily strip-searched because of his skin color and the limp he has walked with since suffering a stroke 13 years ago. He said he's been questioned and harassed by police a number of times in his life, the first time when I was 12 or 13. And since he was not breaking any laws, he did not want to cooperate with them. Alexandrowicz and Mohit left their car and stood in Nemhart's way, according to the complaint. They continue to ask him where he was going, where he lived, and if he was, quote, wanted, unquote. Nemhard said the officers, one white, the other Middle Eastern or South Asian, also shoved him and refused to provide their names and badge numbers. I still don't know why they were stopping me, Nemhard says in his complaint. I asked the officers if they stopped me because I am black. Both of them laughed. They still did not give me a reason for stopping me. Nemhard, who has no criminal record, is seeking $250,000 in compensation for discrimination, mental and physical suffering, and injury to dignity, feelings, and self-respect. Nemhard says the incident has left him feeling degraded and humiliated, fearful of police, and less productive at work. I felt kidnapped, he said, and I was just walking in my neighborhood. Nemhard's lawyers, Barry Swadron and Kelly Bryan, called the police claims outrageous. If it was a white guy with a limp, they would have said, this guy has a disability, said Bryan. Because he's black, they assume he has a weapon. Nemhard said his experience is common to his black friends, but wants others to know too. I want people to know this happens a lot more than they think. That by Brendan Kennedy, staff reporter at the Toronto Star. There will be a day of reckoning. Lawyer Kirk Baird is preparing to take on the provincial government in a multi-billion dollar class action suit, representing a forgotten group of Ontarians. He's confident they'll win. We're more than a match for the province, he says. The government can face reality and settle, or it can go to trial and pay three times as much. His clients are the thousands of mentally ill children and adults locked in insane asylums between 1945 and 2009. Hidden from sight and helpless, they endured decades of sadistic discipline. The first plaintiffs to step forward were two frail but brave elderly women who spent most of their lives in the Huronia Regional Center, once known as the Orillia Asylum for Idiots. They filed affidavits describing beatings, sexual abuse, and degrading forms of punishment. Their personal testimony, plus the evidence Barrett and his legal team rounded up, police reports, witness accounts, newspaper exposés dating back four decades, and successive government inquiries that produced no action, convinced an Ontario Superior Court judge to certify a groundbreaking class action suit last year. Today, all of Ontario's 16 residential facilities for the mentally disabled are closed, but they left a legacy of blighted lives, damaged bodies, and appalling secrets. Baird is determined to get the whole story out in the open, get the province to acknowledge the wrong it did, and get redress for the victims. They were society's most vulnerable members, yet we treated them worse than people convicted of serious crimes, almost as if they were animals. There will be a day of reckoning. But the Toronto lawyer is not the real force behind this quest for justice. It was social worker Marilyn Dolmage who started the ball rolling 10 years ago. When she was a child, her younger brother was sent to Huronia with Down syndrome. He died at 8 years of age of untreated pneumonia. That motivated her to get a job at Huronia. During her 5 years on staff, she witnessed residents being medicated against their will, locked in caged cots, and punished harshly for behavior they could not control. She sounded the alarm repeatedly to inspectors, regulators, and politicians to no avail. Finally, as a last resort, she decided on legal action. She compiled many examples of abuse, persuaded two former residents to tell their stories in court, and contacted Baird, who agreed to represent the former residents. Nothing like this has ever happened in Ontario's courts before. The province has no contingency fund to cover claims of this magnitude. The history of class action suits in the public sector is still young. What is certain, however, is that the province's next government, regardless of who heads it, will be held to account for one of the ugliest chapters in Ontario's history. That by Carol Gore in the Toronto Star. Fired Tim Hortons cancer patient gets her job back. For 6 months, Kathy Horn, 44, has battled cancer on two fronts. Separate surgeries in July and August for melanoma required nearly 10 inches of skin grafting on the right side of her face. In September, she underwent a hysterectomy for cervical cancer. Earlier this month, the Star investigated a surprising letter the Tim Hortons hostess received from her franchise owner September 12th. It said she'd been fired. Now, after nearly 2 weeks of cancer treatments and confusion, Horan has been reinstated. Horan said she provided two letters from her doctor over the summer, even dropping off the second one in person. Cheryl Nelson, who owns the Delhi franchise with her husband, Grant, claims she never received the second note. The Nelsons also run a Tim Hortons in Simcoe, where Horan worked before transferring to Delhi. It's not in our nature to force people out the door, Nelson said. We didn't know where Kathy was. Yet pay stubs were sent to Horan's address, which hadn't changed, and managers frequently called her to come in for work. Voicemails left by the Nelsons, obtained by the Star, indicate management and store workers did have her number. If the Nelsons had a reasonable prospect of knowing Horan was undergoing medical treatment, they cannot just let her go without further inquiries, said Tina K. Lee, an associate lawyer at Witten and Lublin, an employment law firm. Grant Nelson said Horan is welcome back whenever she's ready. Horan, however, doesn't know if she can trust the Nelsons. Still, the grandmother of 13 wants to go back to work in November, and her options in Delhi are limited. I need a job, she said, but I don't know. I don't know if they'll look for any little reason to fire me. Josh Tapper, staff reporter in the Toronto Star. Anger at pet policy incident. Blind roaming champion guide dog turned away at gas station. In just over a week, Victoria Nolan has gone from winning silver at the World Rowing Championships in Bled, Slovenia, to being told she and her guide dog weren't welcome at an Esso station. The 36-year-old, who has lost all but 3% of her vision to a degenerative eye disease, was with her guide dog and following her husband, Eamon, into an Esso station with a coffee outlet at O'Connor Drive and Coxwell Avenue in Toronto on Sunday, when she heard a man shouting at her to leave. He started yelling, saying, "You can't come in here. There's no pets allowed in here," recalled Nolan. She says she told the Esso employee, "This isn't a pet, it's a guide dog." And he said, "I don't care," and told her to get out. An Esso spokesperson said it was looking into the matter. "This is a regrettable incident," said Laura Bishop, a spokesperson for Imperial Oil, which owns Esso. "What I can tell you is our retailers are instructed to allow service dogs on our retail sites and convenience stores. We cannot allow animals that are not service animals into our stores due to health regulations." And that from Torstar News Service in the free paper, the Metro News. And a story that may resonate with Hamiltonians. Live free, ride hard, and maybe die. So a cyclist is to be fined $3.75 after striking a 74-year-old man who was walking peacefully along a sidewalk at Finch Avenue West and Sentinel Road on August 4th. Nobu Okamoto died of his injuries. Days after Okamoto died, cyclists were still blithely riding along the path despite an anguished hand-lettered notice tied to a post by the dead man's family. The cyclist had no business being there, nor on any sidewalk. Why are pedestrians so cheap? The tunnel under the Gardner would be a particularly lonely place to die if you're on foot, I think nervously. A crashed car would be noticed right away, but a bashed pedestrian could lie there for hours, particularly in the almost poetically barren bike lane. Anonymity bestows power. At least cars have license plates, but cyclists without licenses or even ID necessarily can't be identified or arrested unless there's a cop handy. One cyclist looks very much like another, especially in those oversized helmets that any Toronto pedestrian would be wise to wear when leaving the house for a stroll slash brush with death. Here's the food chain starting at the top. SUVs, cars, cyclists, pedestrians, pedestrians with strollers, pedestrians listening to iPods. Each segment includes kind, well-intentioned, safety-minded people. Each segment includes people who will be injured or die horribly because someone thought every street was Thunder Road. Bike lanes were for cars. Crossing signals didn't apply to them. Or sidewalks were for bikes. Live free, ride hard. The police say they're going to crack down. How will it help? Toronto's $70 fine doesn't scare anyone. In Hamilton, it's $50. Neither would cycling points or helmet confiscation. Ask the Star reporters who regularly film and question cyclists who ride through red lights or along a sidewalk and then shapeshift to justify themselves. A bike does not have to follow car rules, they say. A bike is like a pedestrian. Not true, not in the eyes of the law. The weak, unenforceable GTA patchwork law. In the eyes of the pedestrian, the one with the shredded skin, broken bones, and leaking blood, your bike is just the machine that hit him. Your car is the monster that hung a lazy right without thinking of a small two-wheeled machine. Toronto streets should be a delight, not a hospital waiting room, while police and politicians delay, the miserable city limps on day by day. And that by Heather Malik in the Toronto Star. And now, two-thirds of the way through the show, Tennessee Pusher has something to tell you about Alabama High Test.
Alabama High Test got me in a big mess. Higher than a wildcat, they're running from the wolf pack. They're gonna put me in the slammer if they catch me with that Alabama High Test. 65 southbound, cruising with a half pound, blue light spinning round, better put the hammer down. Good old Tennessee, ain't nobody stopping the short run. State line, gotta keep making time, Alabama High Test. Well, huff paint, cocaine, playing chicken with a train, smack dab, meth lab, mellow out. We have Percocet, cigarette, I don't need no more of that, but give me some down home Dixie fried homegrown, Alabama High Test. With that Alabama High Test. Drug bust, discus, plead with the circuit judge. Son, don't be caught. Sign you off the river for jumps. Chain gang, shackles on my feet and hands, standing on a 65 wishing I was rolling by with Alabama High Test.
Alabama High Test, Alabama High Test, got me in a big mess, higher than a wildcat. They're gonna put me in the slammer if they catch me with that Alabama High Test.
Increasingly amid the cobwebs in our good news department is this story from Vancouver. Supreme Court backs Insight Drug Clinic. Decision upends government policy just as Ottawa prepares to push tough anti-crime bill through Parliament. The Supreme Court of Canada has dealt a stern rebuke to the Harper government's law and order agenda in a landmark ruling putting the safety of drug addicts ahead of the Conservatives' hardline stand against illegal drugs. In a strong affirmation of scientific evidence over political beliefs, the court ruled unanimously that Vancouver's Insight Clinic has saved many lives by permitting addicts to self-inject under medical supervision. It ordered Ottawa to exempt medical staff and drug users at the Insight Clinic from drug prosecution, an extremely tough measure for a court with a reputation for acceding to the will of Parliament. Prime Minister Stephen Harper did not conceal his chagrin. "We're disappointed. We have a different policy," he told reporters at a Quebec City news conference. "We'll take a look at the decision, but we will clearly act in respect and within the constraints of the decision." In Vancouver, the decision was greeted with delight by a broad coalition of drug users, politicians, police, and the medical establishment. Activists elsewhere in the country immediately began pressing for similar clinics. That in the Globe and Mail Saturday, October 1st, by Kirk Macon, Justice Reporter. Legal ruling opens doors for more supervised injection sites. In Vancouver, there was a sigh of relief. In Montreal, a ray of hope. The Supreme Court of Canada's decision to save Insight ended a years-long battle over North America's only legal supervised injection facility. Within hours of the ruling, Vancouver health officials were discussing a second site and how to incorporate supervised injection into other treatment programs. The High Court's ruling won't just keep InSight open. Montreal's public health director said it paves the way for his city to create at least one supervised injection facility. This settles the legal question once and for all, Richard Lessard said. Liz Evans, executive director of the Portland Hotel Society, which operates InSight along with Vancouver Coastal Health, fought back tears as she thanked and honored the drug users of this community who paved the way for this site with their lives. Patricia Daly, Vancouver Coastal Health's chief medical officer, said while the evidence supports supervised injection, the service doesn't necessarily have to be in a dedicated facility. If we think of the history of the needle exchange, which began in Vancouver with a single fixed site exchange and now has been incorporated into the services that we offer to people suffering from addictions, you can envision how we might do the same with supervised injection in the future, she said. Those are discussions we need to have. Julio Montana, director of the BC Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS, said he can see the day in the not-so-distant future where harm reduction will be embedded within our healthcare system as an ethical, necessary, mandated part of the support that we provide to individuals who are addicted. PHS, Portland Hotel Society, has already drawn up plans for a second InSight facility, but Ms. Evans wouldn't say, or couldn't say, I'm sorry, when it might be open. That story by Sonny Dillon in Vancouver and Ingrid Peritz in Montreal in the Globe and Mail, Saturday, October 1st. Recession's effects persist at food banks. The good news is that visits to food banks in the GTA have subsided, a new report by the Daily Bread Food Bank says. The bad news is that the visits still remain 14% higher than pre-recession levels. The situation is alarming, said Gail Nyberg, executive director for the Daily Bread Food Bank. Since the recession, Ontario food banks have seen an 8% increase in 2009, followed by a 15% jump in 2010, the largest single increase in visits they have seen in decades. Since then, it looks good that we have a 9% drop, she said, but it's not that surprising the numbers have gone down since that high point during the recession. With the uncertain economy, it's nerve-wracking that we have so many visits still, she added. Ms. Nyberg also said the demands in the suburbs are growing. At 84%, Toronto still has the majority of all visits in the GTA, but the number of visits to food banks in the 905 area jumped 13% from 2008 to 2011. The Daily Bread report also found that job losses and an inability to find work are driving more people with higher education to the food banks, with the percentage of food bank users with a university or postgraduate degree rising to 28% in 2011 from 21% in 2006. Of those, 63% were newcomers to Canada. It's not easy keeping a job as a newcomer, even if qualified, said Ratna Omidvar, president of diversity advocacy group Maitri. If you are the last hire, then you are the first to get fired. Many of these parents are working multiple jobs to make ends meet, and sometimes money runs out. The report also found that 25% of food bank users had someone in their household who was working for an average of 20 hours a week. A part-time job, even paying above minimum wage, is not a sustainable option, and as a result, the working poor are accessing food banks too, Ms. Nyberg said. Coupled with waiting times of 5 to 15 years to access subsidized government housing, the rising cost of housing in the GTA is also a major contributing factor for hunger and poverty. The report states that after paying for housing, the average food bank client is left with only $5.67 to spend on food, transportation, and other living expenses per day, and that includes tax benefits. It comes down to people being forced to choose between paying their rent and eating food, said Shelley White, co-chair of the Mississauga Summit. That story by Tamara Baluja in the Globe and Mail. Health Accord may hinge on Ontario vote. Stephen Harper will be pressed to commit to a new 10-year health accord, or he may be let off the hook on any long-term promise, depending on the outcome of the Ontario provincial election. Both Liberal leader Dalton McGuinty and the NDP's Andrea Horwath want the Harper government to negotiate a second decade-long health accord with the provinces. Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak is the outlier. Asked if he would push the Prime Minister for a second 10-year accord, Mr. Hudak would only say he wants funding to continue. The Harper government has promised to continue the health accord's 6% annual escalations for 2 years beyond its expiry date in 2014. Mr. McGuinty is critical of the Harper for not being able to commit to something beyond 2 years. The problem, he said, is that Medicare cannot be reformed in the short term, and this is why he wants another 10-year deal, like the one signed in 2004 between the premiers and Paul Martin's short-lived Liberal government. Mr. McGuinty said improving care for seniors, keeping them at home and out of hospitals and long-term care facilities, would keep health costs down and take pressure off the system. Ms. Horvath, meanwhile, is also concerned that the deadline is quickly approaching. She met in Ottawa with the federal NDP caucus, and much of her discussion revolves around the necessity of beginning negotiation on a long-term deal, she said in an interview. Her plan, however, would also emphasize long-term care, palliative care, and home care, and she supports the 6% escalation as a target. A recent Nanos poll showed health care is the number one issue of concern for Ontario voters. That story by Jane Tabor and Kim McCrail in the Globe and Mail. Fat and fertility. Should obese women have access to costly reproductive therapies? Canadian doctors are considering a policy that would bar obese women from trying to have babies through fertility treatments, provoking debate over whether the fat have the same reproduction rights as the thin. We've had many angry patients say to us, "This is discriminatory," and I say, "Yes, it is, but I still won't do it," said Arthur Leader, co-founder of the Ottawa Fertility Center. The facility where he works will not treat women with a body mass index, a measurement of weight relative to height, of more than 35. A BMI of 30 meets the clinical definition of obese. "A patient doesn't have the right to make a choice that's going to be harmful to them," he said. "You'd be denying half the reproductive population from gaining access to fertility treatment," said Anthony Chung, a fertility expert at the University of British Columbia and Grace Fertility Center. "These people already know they have a problem. Are you going to make it worse? Add to feelings of social injustice, low self-worth, depression? It may be for some women that this is wise advice, but it's ethically troubling," said the University of Manitoba's Arthur Schaefer, director of the Center for Professional and Applied Ethics. "In our society, the decision to procreate is left to the individual. So why would it be appropriate for doctors to usurp those rights for women who are obese? Research has shown women who are severely overweight require higher doses of fertility drugs to spur ovulation, increasing the risk of side effects. As well, obese women face a greater risk of developing high blood pressure, which can trigger strokes, and gestational diabetes, which can pose risks to mother and baby. While these risks during pregnancy apply to obese women, even if they conceive naturally, Carl Laskin, president of the CFAS, believes fertility doctors have a responsibility to address them if a woman wants to conceive with medical help. "If you don't think a woman should become pregnant for medical reasons, you have no business helping her to become pregnant. But it's a tough, tough message to deliver. There's usually lots of tears," said Dr. Laskin, adding that he asked the women to return every 3 months to evaluate their weight loss. Dr. Leader asks that women bring their BMI below 35 to receive treatment. He knows some clinics won't treat women with a BMI of 30. 30, he said, is a bit extreme. That story by Carolyn Abram in the Globe and Mail. Don't forget, lung cancer is also a woman's disease. The Shoppers Drug Mart weekend to end women's cancers is a fundraising juggernaut. This well-oiled machine raises a dizzying amount of money for cancer research, provides a lot of publicity for its principal sponsor and makes participants feel good about their contributions. Initially, the event was called the Weekend to End Breast Cancer, but competition in the breast cancer fundraising field is fierce, with other monster events such as the CIBC Run for the Cure, whose proceeds go to the Canadian Breast Cancer Foundation, which in turn funds research. Raising money for women's cancers made the event more distinctive while also broadening its appeal. In addition to breast cancer, funds now go to research for 5 gynecological cancers: ovarian, cervical, uterine, vaginal, and vulvar. Those are all legitimate causes and areas where research will benefit women, but here's what rankles. There is a cancer that kills more women than those 6 cancers combined. It's lung cancer. Do you know what the symbol is for lung cancer survivors? The clear ribbon, the invisible ribbon for the largely invisible survivors. For every 2 women diagnosed with breast cancer, 1 will be diagnosed with lung cancer. 5 years after diagnosis, 9 of 10 women with breast cancer will be alive. Only 4 of 10 women with lung cancer will have survived. That's pretty dismal. More dismal still is this harsh reality. It's easy to raise money for breast cancer research because there is an army of survivors, many of whom have compelling stories and are willing to take to the streets. Lung cancer patients, even when they survive after diagnosis, tend to have a pretty grim quality of life. Unlike breast cancer, effective treatments are almost non-existent. Not only do they have to contend with a devastating illness, but they must do so under a choking cloud of stigma. Lung cancer patients are probably the only ones who get blamed for their fate. That's because the leading cause of lung cancer is smoking. But lung cancer can also be caused by exposure to secondhand smoke, asbestos, and other industrial products. And let's not forget why many women smoke in the first place. Social pressure. The pressure to be thin is the single biggest reason young women take up smoking and continue to do so in significant numbers. And the need to support their families is the principal reason women take jobs that put them in harm's way, expose them to industrial carcinogens. Not to mention that many women are exposed to secondhand smoke in the home if their spouse is a smoker, and they don't always have the power to change that situation. Let's not kid ourselves. Lung cancer is a women's cancer, the most deadly one of all. That it does not manifest in a body part unique to women makes it no less so. The reality is that one of the principal underlying causes of cancer, breast, lung, or otherwise, is socioeconomic status. Poverty is, or at least it should be, a top women's health issue because it is one of the chief drivers of cancer. Never mind that it is difficult to package that message pretty in pink. The research dollars invested in lung cancer are paltry, wildly out of balance with the magnitude of the disease. Wouldn't it be wonderful if fundraisers used some of their might to do right? After all, their goal is purported to be an end to women's cancers. And that by Andre Picard in his column Second Opinion in the Globe and Mail. Baby Joseph has died. Baby Joseph, whose parents fought to get him a tracheotomy after an Ontario hospital refused to perform one, has died at his home in Windsor. Mo Marachli, Joseph's father, said on Tuesday, September 27th, that his 20-month-old son had died. The baby had a progressive and fatal neurological disease, and his parents' wishes for his care put the family at the center of a months-long controversy. The couple ended up taking Joseph to a U.S. hospital for the tracheotomy in March, after doctors in London, Ontario, determined the procedure was futile. The doctors at London Health Sciences Center said the baby should be removed from life support because he would not recover from the rare neurological condition that had left him in a vegetative state. But the parents feared Joseph would suffer a painful death once his ventilator was removed. They asked for a tracheotomy, the surgical insertion of a breathing tube in his throat, so they could take him home to live his final days surrounded by his family. You may recall that the tracheotomy was necessitated because a breathing tube had been left in the baby's throat far too long. An observer close to the family thinks that the hospital charged with his care overfed him deliberately, so he would choke and die. The couple lost an 18-month-old daughter to the same neurological disease, Leigh syndrome. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Disrespect's email has been blocked. We don't know why. We assume it's because the provider wants a paying customer despite his offer of a free service. So stick with us. We'll have a new email soon. In the meantime, don't place your email with radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU. To see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.